introduction. This is tape number 2 of the interview for the Purdue Archives with Kenneth B. Woods, Civil Engineering at Purdue. It is recorded at 455 Littleton Street on the afternoon of May 26, 1970. When we went off the tape yesterday, we were talking about the permafrostic development and your work in Alaska and in Canada. Let's start out with that today. You were talking, you just mentioned before we went on the tape, about some consulting in Greenland. Would you care to start with that?
Okay, sir.
Now, incidentally, I'm Mr. Eccles. Go ahead.
My first trip to Greenland was in the summer in June of 1954. I was the chief consultant for the commanding officer on the first Arctic Task Force, Colonel A.H. Lalom. And I was chosen because of my experience in permafrost in Alaska and Canada. And a few engineers at that time had much experience, and this was one of the reasons why.
Now, I asked you that question yesterday about Russians. Were they better than we were? And you said, maybe, but not anymore.
That's correct.
All right.
And some of Tuvalu Greenland work improved our status a great deal in the eyes of the world, of the people that had to deal with permafrost. You know, permafrost at Tuvalu Greenland is close to 2,000 feet deep. And at Point Barrow, Alaska, it's well over 1,000 feet deep. And we're not talking about an insignificant landform when we talk about permafrost. I was at Tuvalu twice, in 54 and in 55. On the first trip, I spent most of the time on the ice cap. But also, there's a 20-mile coastal plain of permafrost, and when the snow and ice is melted, as it does do in the summer, we have what is known as patterned ground, and it's intriguing to notice the patterned ground, the similarity between that and the similarity with materials we find in northern Alaska and northern Canada. And I fudged a little on my consulting and did a lot of bumming around in the bush, so to speak, because I was intrigued with these landforms and I became very interested, and even was able to get a helicopter, my Army helicopter, on a couple of occasions and take me quite a ways from base. And almost cracked up once too, by the way. Missed the ground by about a foot on a downsweep from the ice sheet. On my second, in 1954, first of all, I was there with Colonel Lalom and went out to the ice cap, the 20 miles in an old Army truck, and I didn't much more than get there until somebody came in a jeep and said, "Don't go up on the ice cap, the colonel wants to see you back at the base." And I said, "Well, I just left the base." And he said, "I don't know what he wants, but he wants to see you right now." Well, he was my boss, he was the colonel, and I kept wondering why in the world he didn't tell me before I came that 20 miles. That's a horrible trip. Rough and uneven and uncomfortable. But of course I obeyed and I went back to base. I reported at his office, and he had an aide come out and tell me that he was out to the airport to meet a bunch of generals that were coming in, and he couldn't see me right away, and I was to go to quarters. Well, that worried me a little more. I wondered what I'd done wrong, why he wanted to see me, and I But I had lots of work to do, and you had very little time. They worked you 14, 15 hours a day and a half a day on Sunday to boot. And you didn't even have time to, not much time to write a letter home, let alone catch up on your notes and things like this. So I stayed in my bunk and worked. And the noon hour came, and I went out and got a bite to eat, and I came back, and nothing happened. And about 4:30 in the afternoon, the Jeep pulled up, and it was Colonel Allen. And he said, "Climb in." So I climbed in the Jeep, and he didn't talk all the way out to the edge of the ice cap where all the parties were. And they were, some of them were staying in tents then. They have more permanent buildings now. And we drove that entire 20 miles, and I could have been with a stranger. And I was sure that I had done something terribly wrong. And that was on the first day of July 1954. And as we got to camp, I noticed all the crews were in, off the ice cap. There must have been 60 or 70 scientists, maybe more. And I wondered at that. Now, why are all these people here? They don't normally come in. The sun shines 24 hours a day, and they work and work and work and take a little sleep and work some more. But we went in the big dining tent, and there they were, all collected. And Lalum got up on a little keg, nail keg, and he said, "Gentlemen, come to order. Today is the first day that K.B. Woods is head of the School of Civil Engineering at Purdue. Let's give him a toast." And I never felt so relieved in my life. In 1955, I went back again, and I to Thule, and on this occasion, they had another commanding officer, but I'd been there the year before, and I knew the ropes quite well by then. And these were crevasse parties and parties on ground configurations and all kinds of activities concerned with the Arctic, how to live in this region. And I met an interesting individual, Sir Hubert Wilkins. And I went out on the ice cap with him on a couple of occasions, and we got to be quite good friends. And on one of these occasions, I said to him, "I remember that you used to give lectures at universities and colleges. What would it cost us to have you come to Purdue?" And he, you know, he's an Australian mining engineer, long since deceased now, but and he had his home in close to Boston. Incidentally, that's where he lives, his permanent home. And he said that his normal lecture for an hour was $2,000, but normally he'd add in 15 minutes for questions, which would be free. And I tried when I came back to get our convocation group to invite him to come out, and I never was able to achieve that. And that was one of my disappointments in life, that I never was able to get Sir Hubert Wilkins on the campus. But on one of the occasions when we had met at the stated point at the ice cap, waiting for the Army truck, it hadn't arrived at the end of the day, he went in one direction, Wilkins, and I went in another, always looking at the battering ground and looking at interesting things connected with permafrost. And I came upon a big granite boulder. As a matter of fact, it's right over there in the room. It's the largest, it has the coarsest grains of granite that I've ever known. And I decided I'd like to bring that to Lafayette. And I went back to the truck had come in the meantime, and I put that under the seat and climbed in the truck, and a group of us went back to the base camp, the 20 miles away. And when I got out of the truck, I reached in and got my granite boulder, And Wilkins said, "What do you have?" And I told him what I thought it was, a granite boulder with lichens on it. And I had the coarsest grains of granite that I'd ever seen. And he said, "What are you going to do with it?" And I said, "Well, I think I'll take it to Lafayette." And he said, "What? Charge the government a freight bill for taking a piece of rock to Lafayette, Indiana?" And I said, "Oh, now listen, I traveled only with half the load that I'm normally allowed, and they go light this time of year going back, and this won't cost the government a penny." And by the time he gave me about 20 more minutes of lectures, I felt like it was a penny. And when he knew he had me beaten pretty badly, he reached in his coat pocket and he said, "Well, the only trouble is yours is bigger than mine." And he had one too. I had another interesting experience on that particular mission. I wanted to get home. As we mentioned yesterday, my birthday is August 14. And so I made arrangements with the commanding officer to come back so I'd be home for my birthday and be with my family. And I left Thule on the 13th. And between Thule and Sonderstrom, that's about the Arctic Circle, it's 1,000 miles to the south of Thule, Greenland. And at Sonderstrom, it's a fjord, a rather dangerous one, but we pulled in there and I knew there was something wrong, or they would be stopping, because normally they were going on to Labrador and get a gas stop and then come on into the States. But when we stopped, we were put in a room and briefed. And the briefing consisted of the fact that we were having hurricanes in the States in 1955 in August, bad ones, and that they had to put us up in Sonderstrom until these eased up because they couldn't get in the States. And so we stayed all night. The next morning, I went down to the base for breakfast and came back to quarters, and I saw three men wearing what I considered underwear, that's all. And I thought that strange. They were unshaven, haggard, and but they asked me where they could get something to eat. And I said, "Well, you can't go to the officers' quarters and eat like that, but there's another mess," and I told them where it was, and they thanked me and went on their way. So I kind of watched for these boys. I was curious as to who they were and why they were wearing underwear. And when they came back, I asked them, "What in the world? Why are you boys wearing underwear?" And the leader said, "Sir, we're stationed at Thule." And I said, "Well, that's 1,000 miles away." And he said, "Did you ever hear of ice fog?" And I said, "Oh, yes." And he said, "We were on an ice mission." That's, they would go up along the Greenland coast and seek out the icebergs and ice reconnaissance for navigation purposes. And when we came back, he said, "When we came back to Thule, we had an ice fog on the runway and it wouldn't let us land. And they told us to go to Sonderstrom." And this man was the pilot, and he said, "I told him we didn't have enough gas to get to Sonderstrom. It's 1,000 miles. And the orders were, you go to Sonderstrom." And you know, when you land in this kind of water, you last about, 12, 15 minutes. It's cold. It's just a little bit above 32, and there are icebergs in it. And these boys knew they were going to run out of gas, so they kept their plane very low and conserved their fuel as best they could. And they kept sending out SOSs for help as they neared Sonderstrom. They knew the gas gauge was showing empty, and they knew they were going to have to ditch it, they thought, at least. And but they couldn't get across this fjord rock front with their radio, you see. But an army tanker, gasoline tanker, flying above them to Sonderstrom, picked up their messages. And so the pilot of that plane said, "Okay, boys, you are in trouble. We'll come down and we'll fly right above you and we'll guide you in and we'll get help for you." And so they called the base and told the difficulty they were having, and they got in the fjord and they kept going, and just as they hit the run, just as they started to glide down, they ran out of gas. And they got on the runway and didn't wreck the plane, and the pilot said, "And we got drunk as hell after that." That's all I think of Tula Greenland.
You helped, in other words, do the study that made it possible to build that base.
No. I had staff that did, and it's an odd thing that in 1951 was the year that I led the expedition that went down the Mackenzie River in the boat and the bush pilots, and on that, and we had a radio on this boat, and the best station we could get was Moscow. By far the best reception. And we got on, that was a secret then. And my staff couldn't tell me where they were going. They were going north someplace, but they couldn't tell me where they were going because it was classified and they could not tell where that was supposed to be a secret. But I learned from the Russians on that boat all about Tule Greenland, and I got a daily report.
Certainly, there's a story out of how the Russians discovered it.
I don't believe I know it.
The story I heard is that there was absolute top secrecy, and then the Russians came out with their radio report and welcomed Tule, and the Americans there described the base, particularly the dimensions. The Coast and Geodetic Survey is under orders by law to publish the description, dimensions, and so on, of every installation of the United States government. So it cost the Russians 15 cents to get the complete plans of Tule.
Is that a fact? I never knew
that.
This
is a story I've heard.
Well, you see, it sounds plausible because on this radio, I picked up a daily report of progress on that construction and when the boys came back in the fall and I talked to them, the reports were accurate.
All right, now let's go on to consulting. You know, you haven't said too much about your highway consulting.
Well,
you want to go into that and talk about projects?
Yes, my consulting I've always tried to use extreme caution in the consulting I accepted, and as I mentioned yesterday, you always made certain that in some manner it would be of use to graduate students, and always it would be of credit to my university, Purdue. I didn't want any kind of work that would reflect adversely on my school.
Well, your consulting was then in the nature of your work at Purdue and not independently so that you could become a wealthy man, as it is with many consultants.
No, that's right. I was not then, and I am not now, a wealthy person at all. But my consulting was done primarily for the joy of doing something that somebody else couldn't do and getting it done, and would be a reflection on a favorable reflection on the university.
Did you have a policy of helping young men get out and get jobs consulting and join societies and so on?
Oh, this has been primarily, if I made a contribution, I think it would be in this field. Staff and graduate students, I always pushed the good ones out and helped them. Always did this. This was my main objective.
And as you got them on national committees and had them read reports and papers.
Oh yes. Oh yes. This is pretty fundamental. And I've known some good many consultants that don't do that, did not, and do not.
Do you put your name to papers that graduate students publish if they do it under your supervision?
If I contribute to a project, a sizable amount, my name goes on it. If not, I do not. My name does not go on it. And sometimes my contributions may be rather major amount, and sometimes it would be almost supervisory. But
well, I think that is probably one of the best things you have done for Purdue, is to make its staff, your aides and your students, make its staff known nationally. I hope the university has been properly aware of this.
I think George Hawkins was, and I think Frederick Hovde was. I know they were. They were kept informed constantly of where I was and what I was doing by a note when I go or a note when I come back. Well, even when Dean Potter, before Hawkins Day, he encouraged this too. But there was no conflict. I never had a bit of conflict between my superiors, the head of the school before I became head, R.B. Wiley, Dean Potter, Dean Hawkins, President Hovde, and then in later years, his several vice presidents. And I can speak with fondness about my association with these people because they Lytle Frieffer and Paul Cina, and then later George Hawkins. They were always helpful, and that freed me to be helpful to my people. You see, under me.
All right, then let's go on to most important projects.
Well, we mentioned yesterday. We mentioned the permafrost work, and remember, we mentioned the Varved clays, you remember. And in Labrador, when I was working for the Hanna Company in Cleveland.
And you talked about the railroad there.
Yes, but they had a problem of loading ore on ore, which will, I think, give you a little better picture of the diversity of my interests of the, that I've developed through the years. But it's a funny thing. I was the sole consultant on this. Why they didn't bring other people in, I'll never know, but they didn't. But they loaded this ore up 360 miles to the north in Labrador. It's on the line between Labrador and Quebec. Some of it's Labrador and some of it's province of Quebec. But the peninsula is known as Labrador, geographically, and they would load some of this ore and haul it down to Seven Islands, 360 miles, and they had modern cars, freight cars, ore cars, and they would unload readily onto conveyor belts, which would run the ore into ships, and these ships would, at that time. Before Humphrey, it was about this time that Humphrey was with Eisenhower, and the St. Lawrence Seaway broke. I often wondered if Humphrey didn't have something to do with that breaking. I don't know. But in any event, at that time, the ore was shipped mostly into Baltimore, and then they would put it on Pennsylvania cars, freight cars, and haul it to. You see, the ore interests were, the steel interests were mostly Ohio and Pennsylvania to the west of the Appalachians, at Steubenville, the
And go us to Youngstown, Pittsburgh?
Yes, yes. All there's a group of these. Armco was another one. Mm-hmm. And occasionally, they would get an entire trainload of ore in these old freight cars, which were really coal cars, that they couldn't get the ore out of them. After they hauled them over the hauled the ore over the mountains, they couldn't get it out of the cars. And the boys named this sticky ore. And it became quite a financial problem to these steel people and the Hanna Company, and it became a very critical problem. And they asked me to take a leave of absence and try to solve that problem. And I said, no, I couldn't do that. But if they'd give me three crews, a crew at Seven Islands and a crew at Baltimore, Philadelphia, and a crew out along the Ohio River at one of the plants, I thought that I could solve it by visiting these three groups three or four times, and I thought I could solve it in a matter of weeks, which they bought, and they did do. They equipped these labs, but I played a hunch that it was not chemical, that it was wet ore, and that wetness in part came from permafrost. Now this was strictly a hunch, but when I came back, and they had this big conference in Montreal, I rigged up some equipment and played around in over the weekend in one of our labs, and I could take a wet ore and I could cause it to consolidate such that you couldn't hammer it out of a container. And I was pretty certain by that time that I was on the right track. And we did solve that problem by when it turned out to be a moisture problem. Then they put in drying equipment and they solved it quickly. And they again made their ore competitive, but there was a period when that ore was not competitive, and that's one of the real difficult things that and expensive things that I worked on that they wouldn't let me publish. Obviously, you can see why. Because of the fact that they didn't want to spread it around that they had problems. And then by the time we had it all solved and had their drying equipment in, it just wasn't timely to publish it, and so it never got published. I hope that begins to bring out the point that it's more than highways that I get involved in. I have been involved I've been a consultant, for instance, to University of Toronto on curriculum. I've been a consultant for contractors in Canada who had problems of frost. I've worked on the Burlington Railroad, the Southern Railroad, the Chicago South Shore, South Bend, and of course the Labrador Railroad.
This is in connection with land and shifting of land and so
on. Oh, it'd be landslides. In the States, my problems were primarily concerned, I'd say, with landslides, yes. Movement of big masses of earth and taking track out and...
Or highways, too.
Yes. And I've done quite a little work, quite a little consulting of the same kind for highway departments, too. This is correct. Oh, consulting firms. I remember one big job in Arkansas, consulting firm in St. Louis. Had this, it's one of the early interstate jobs, and they wanted me to work on this project, three or four days is what we did, but to determine whether it ought to be a rigid pavement or a flexible pavement. And now this is a matter of philosophy, which I would bring back to my students, my graduate students. And it's a matter of economics and philosophy. I'm neither pro bituminous or pro concrete. I'm I'm a realist and always have been, and it's a matter of which is the most economical under the situation that you're working with. And in this case, in Arkansas, they were short of good aggregates to work with. This meant that they had to ship in huge quantities of materials. Well, a bituminous pavement might, well, Pennsylvania, the New Jersey Turnpike, for instance, is better than 30 inches thick. And a Portland cement concrete pavement would, at best, would be 10 inches. So there's a great difference in the amount of aggregates you chip in for a rigid pavement versus a flexible pavement. And I signed a report recommending a rigid pavement. I caught a lot of criticism from my flexible pavement friends for making such a recommendation, but this was pure and simple a matter of economics. We spoke yesterday of the peat bog in Ohio. Another interesting job, and this would have been a road job, was in Iran, old Persia. I was called in. Now, some of these jobs, by the way, would pay 50. I think it's, for the record, it's important to indicate that there's quite a varying scale I've worked with. Work for municipalities where they were hard up. Jackson, Ohio is an illustration. That's close to
I know
Athens.
Where Jackson is. I used to go through it.
Well, you know that's a poor community. And my work, I did work on the water supply dam there. I located it and designed it, a dam for water supply for the city of Jackson, for a firm that did the other part of the work, as the piping and the pumping and so on. But I did the earthwork. I designed the slopes, the dam, and so on. And that was one of the most difficult jobs I ever had, and I got $50 a day for it. Because that city was poor, they couldn't afford very much, and I didn't charge them for all the days I worked either. And I didn't charge them for the amount of worry I had building that dam. It's still there, and it'll be there now. But it was on a buried glacial valley that is composed of 20 feet. It's a broad alluvial plain. It's composed of 20 feet of alluvial silt, recent, on top of 20 feet of peat, muck, which is on top of 20 feet of gravel before you hit rock, 60 feet down to rock. And obviously you can't build a 70 or 80 or 90 foot high dam on that kind of material. So we had to locate and get it away from this peaty stuff as much as possible, go up the side of the valley and get a smaller watershed. But we still had some peat and we still had some gravel. Not 20 feet of each, but we still had some. And when we got the last load of earth in that dam and it didn't fail, I knew we'd licked it. But it was up, it was nip and tuck as to whether or not that, whether we could build it and hold it. It was a factor of safety of almost 1.0. But I consider that one of my most difficult jobs. In contrast to the sticky ore for the Hanna Company, these jobs like these would pay $200 a day. And when I'd work for a foreign country as the Persian a job, that would be $400 a day. And when I would serve in court, on court cases as an expert witness, that would always be $400 a day. And that's the hardest work you can do, too, by the way.
Court cases can be very difficult.
Oh, yes. The job in Iran, I was able to solve that. It was a problem of a mixture of soil and ancient gravel, and they had too much soil. But the designers were of the opinion, incorrectly, it turned out, that in a 10 or 12 inch rainfall belt, which a lot of Iran is that and less, at most 20 inches. But they didn't think that this clay would ever get wet because of the low rainfall. They didn't consider the fact that the rain comes in late fall, and they built a stretch of highway and didn't seal it. It was a bituminous surface, but they didn't seal it. You know what I mean by that? They didn't put chips in and fill up the between the big pieces. They were going to do that in the spring. But it rained, as it always does, and it went down through this, got in the clay and this gravel, and of course it failed, and failed quickly. And that kind of a job, you see, they called me from London to come over, and I tried to tell them that if they would just take a little time and get me certain samples, that I thought I could solve it without going to Iran. But they wouldn't have it that way, so I went to Iran, and I had a hunch on this one too that it was the clay gravel mix was causing the problem. It's often said that technical people burn out when they're sometimes 40 years or less of age. I don't believe this when I think of Dean Potter.
Going strong at 88.
That's correct. He's not burned out. He's doing all right. But the best thing I did in publications is this big thick handbook.
This is the handbook on engineering, highway engineering handbook, published by McGraw-Hill. How many editions has it gone through?
I can't tell you, but I'm still getting a couple $1,000 a year in royalties after, and it was published in 1958.
Now that is the handbook for engineers building and maintaining highways.
Yes, but it's pretty broad too, because it has a tremendous chapter in there on permafrost, for instance. We build roads and railroads in permafrost areas, and so there's a section on permafrost in that handbook, which is quite unusual. You would normally not expect it, and that's one of the reasons the book still sells, because it has so much fundamental information that it'll be good for years to come.
Are our interstate highway systems, are they well designed, are they well built, or does it depend on who's doing it?
Oh, I'd say in general they're pretty well done. There are variations, but they do have control on the interstate. The specifications are controlled by the Bureau of Public Roads, because it's federal money that flows back to the states. Most of those interstate roads are 90% federal funds. And the federal government is not just about ready to see a lot of roads built that aren't quite standard. But once in a while, you get a poor contractor, or you get a poor situation in which there wasn't enough exploratory work done on the subsoil, and you will get into some problems. They aren't all perfect, but I would say that the average mile of interstate road is so far superior to the average mile of city streets that there's no comparison.
Is this due to the lack of money, or due to the fact that people that become city engineers usually are not graduate engineers and usually are not up to it?
I think what I'm speaking about, you find in the subdivisions. You go out to West Lafayette or Lafayette in the subdivisions, and you go out over the weekend and drive some of those streets on the other side of the bypass. Well, now those are subdivisions, let the contracts for this, and then they sell the lots. And then people build houses, buy the lots and build houses. And on the average, the interstate roads are so far superior to those that there's no comparison. There is always, where there's lots of money involved, and there's certainly lots involved in the interstate, there's always that one out of a thousand that will take a bribe or get caught. And, of course, they make the headlines, and it makes the interstate look bad.
You know, when speaking about that, I remember the first turnpike, Pennsylvania. That's taken a beating, but it's held up very well. There must have been some pretty good engineering on that. Did you have a part in it?
No, I didn't, but the man that wrote the geometric design for that handbook was the chief engineer for the... the big thick one we're here, was the chief engineer for the Pennsylvania Turnpike Commission. That was built in 1937-38, finished in 39, the first stretch of the turnpike was. And I was still in Ohio when I came here in February 39. And they've had tremendous maintenance costs on it. They've had to replace tremendous mileages of pavement, but after all, it's an old one too.
I remember when that was going through in 1932 and 33.
Yes, yes, it was an old railroad alignment. There were grand dreams back before the turn of the century of building a railroad through that country through tunnels. And they had the tunnels opened up, but they never did the rest of it. And so the turnpike idea came to somebody, I don't remember whose idea it was, of using the same alignment, buying it rather cheaply.
The man you're talking about is Charles M. Noble?
That's correct. Right. Charles Noble, yes. He was later a director of highways for Ohio. I don't know just how this happened that he came to Ohio. He's retired now, of course, but so far as I know, still living. But Charles Noble is correct. There's some pretty important people in that handbook. Noble being one of them, but Rex Whitten is another, and he was Federal Highway Administrator under the Eisenhower administration. But before that, he was chief engineer for the Missouri Highway Department, and a real fine person and a good friend of mine. And he wrote the section on maintenance.
Yes.
And of course, that is a little, now that type of thing is a little obsolete now because maintenance changes with these new interstate concepts. But
fundamentally, it's still a good thing to read.
That's correct.
Now we've talked about two major publications. Why don't we go ahead on those? What else now?
Well, let me sum this up here a little bit. This consulting, and it won't take but a moment. I would like to indicate my opinion, some work on the at Bangor, Maine, for the Corps of Engineers on a big airfield that I worked on several years ago. I'm real proud of that work. I would say that a colleague of mine, T.E. Shelburne, and I worked for a couple of years on a project at Purdue to try to find out what caused what was then known as pumping of rigid pavements. They called it pumping. And there were all kinds of theories as to why that happened, but we buttoned it up pretty accurately, largely through travel, and finding that it occurred on heavily traveled roads, truck traffic type of roads, in clay-like areas where the rainfall was 30, 40, 50 inches. And it was quite a contribution, I think, that that publication was a Highway Research Board publication, but it was a Purdue effort, and through our own Purdue labs that we ran that down. Summing up, though, the consulting, I made a few notes here. I've worked for about 30 companies, firms, contractors, construction firms, government agencies, Air Force, Corps of Engineers, and so on. I've worked in at least 40 states, in five territories and provinces of Canada, for Denmark, or in Denmark, that would be Thule, Greenland. I've done work for Brazil, South America, for the Hanna Company again, and I've been in Iran. I think that fairly well sums up my consulting work. Now, what did you want to go on to next?
Well, we've been talking about projects and consulting, and according to our outline, you have next publications, and you have there most important. I assume that means
yes.
Two things. It means it's important that we get them down, and it also means that it's important for you to list them in as near order of priority as you can.
All right. I think I have those too for you, so that we'll cut down our time.
Take all the time you want.
Publications, we've touched on those some already. The handbook and the permafrost proceedings and the Bulletin 87 of the Engineering Experiment Station at Purdue, this one right here.
Now, the Bulletin 87, let me just be sure we get the title in. It is the Formation, Distribution, and Engineering Characteristics of Soils by D.J. Belcher, L.E. Gregg, G.R.E.G.G., and Kenneth B. Woods of the Joint Highway Research Project. Now, that was published under the State Highway Commission of Indiana, the Engineering Experiment Station.
Correct.
Very good, sir. That was January 1943.
Correct. And that book started Joint Highway to be recognized. That was a real good piece of work. And those authors are listed. We all did our part of making contributions. I mean, I would not hesitate a moment to, matter of fact, they weren't with me very long after that came out. They got good jobs elsewhere. Belcher went to Cornell, and Gregg went to University of Kentucky, and that was one of the early fine publications that put Joint Highway on its feet.
Good.
Then through Joint Highway, we entered into many contracts, sometimes government or sometimes private, through the Engineering Experiment Station, but we used Joint Highway labs, and we would charge their time to the contract, not to Joint Highway and that sort of thing. But one of the very important projects that came out of it was this Bulletin 52 of the Civil Aeronautics Administration then. You may want to read that.
May I read that into the tape? It's the origin, distribution, and air photo identification of United States soils with special reference to airport and highway engineering by D.S. Jenkins, Civil Aeronautics Administration, D.J. Belcher, L.E. Gregg, and K.B. Wood of Purdue University, Technical Development Report Number 2, issued May 1946 by the Department of Commerce, Civil Aeronautics Administration.
Well, not 52 instead of 2. Technical Report Number 52.
Technical Report Number 5-2.
Yes.
Yes.
All right.
May 1946.
I would call attention in that publication to, you won't need to get it out, but there is folders in the back of it.
Oh, I see.
A color map. Showing the distribution of soils in the United States. And it's the first engineering publication of that kind. The agricultural people have done it for agricultural purposes, but engineering had never been done. And this man, Greg, and I drew the boundaries for those soil areas that later became the soils map. And Greg took the area east of the Mississippi River, and I took the area west of the Mississippi River. He hadn't been west, and I had, and this was a logical divide. Of the four authors, he and I did the legwork on collecting the literature that was necessary, and then drawing the boundaries for the soils map of the United States. I consider that these publications, I think, are the kind that are likely to live for a good many years. They're not something that comes along and quickly.
They will not easily be replaced either by technology or by science.
That's correct. And that caused me, I was thinking about that this morning, and caused me to wonder about civil engineering in general. If I could think of some publications that and I immediately thought of two. One was the publication that's not Purdue, by the way, but it was a publication that was distributed about 1900 through the American Society of Civil Engineers and was known as, quote, Fuller's Curve, end of quote, which means that it was a gradation of gravel or sand or stone such that you got the most particles, or the greatest density per cubic foot. And that is as fundamental today as it was 70 years ago.
Because the soils haven't changed much.
That's correct. It's a real fundamental piece of work. And I have been to meetings in the last 25 years and heard some young fellow that was not properly guided go before the National Research Council and present a paper, which would be essentially Fuller's Curve, and then to see some old-timer at that time get up and say, son, if you look in the proceedings of the ASCE in 1900, you'll find it's already been done. And that's pretty sad.
Well, their instructors should have made that impossible for them.
That's correct.
I had a good set of instructors, and I learned that it's somewhat difficult for a young man to come up with something absolutely and totally new. He may add a little corner to it, but it's difficult in a search.
Well, there's another one that I think of that came out about 1915. It came out of the Portland Cement Association by a man with the name of Duff Abrams, and it was known as the water-cement ratio. In other words, the ratio between the amount of cement and the amount of water is the key to getting the best grade of concrete. And the ratio should be kept as low as possible so long as you can work it well. And that work is just as fundamental in 1970 as it was in 1915.
Let me ask, sir, at this point, has changes in machinery and made a great deal of effect on the development of concrete and of earth moving. Of course, earth moving is important. You can move earth very rapidly. But you're talking about concrete. Can you mix it or fine with new machines or something like this in order to make it cheaper? I just don't know. I'm asking for your opinion.
The earthwork, taking that first for a moment, earthwork today costs about the same as it did 30 years ago per yard because of advances made in equipment. It doesn't cost, and that's a strange thing to say, but the cost of moving a yard of earth is about the same today as it was 30 years ago.
That's in spite of higher individual cost for a machine and, of course, labor.
That's correct. Well, of course, there's much less labor. It's one of the reasons it's less costly. Now, the field of concrete, for many, many years, I chaired a national committee of the American Society for Testing and Materials on concrete and concrete aggregates, and it was a large committee made up of perhaps 150 of the foremost people in the country in the field of concrete, Portland cement concrete. And research continues even today in the field of Portland cement concrete. As a matter of fact, you and I have spoken a couple of times about our mutual friend Bill Dolch.
Yes.
And this is where he did his thesis, was in this field, in Portland cement concrete, cement paste. There have been many advances made since Duff Abrams did his work on water-cement ratio. But that doesn't mean that water-cement ratio is not a fundamental concept. But we have made great advances in through this committee on ASTM that I mentioned, and through the American Concrete Institute. These two groups continue to turn out fine research, and this is one of the things that makes it a little more difficult to sell civil engineering in a general way than electrical engineering, as an example, because it's not really known too well, certainly not by students, there's been a lot of pretty fundamental work done in the field of Portland cement concrete or the field of asphaltic concrete, and continues to be made. Contributions continue. And so just because television is new and concrete is old doesn't mean that there aren't still advances to be made.
You're talking about these honor societies, and you're chairman of this. Just for the record, how many societies have you been president or chairman of national committees?
Oh, well, this American Society for Testing and Materials, that's been a tremendous thing in my life, not only to me but to my colleagues, because through the fact that I've been through the mill, I've been able to help fellows like Bill Dolch and John McLaughlin and many others, and many people that used to be here that are not now.
Remember John Gaffey?
Oh, indeed I do. Oh, yes.
The hardest working man in civil engineering I've ever known.
Yes, I used to wonder whether John was going to make it, but he did. he was a terrific person, that's right. But he was a little old to be going back to school, and this made it doubly hard for the fellow, and he got to give that man a tremendous amount of credit because he did come through.
I lived next door to John. He worked 20 hours a day for a while.
I wouldn't doubt it. Well, I first was on the papers committee of this American Society for Testing Materials, and that was about 1940, during the war, 43 or 4. And I was on that committee 9 years, and then I was elected to the board of directors of ASTM, and from there I was moved up to the vice presidency, and they have two vice presidents, and I served ultimately in 1958 I was elected president of this entire society. Now that is a society made up of perhaps 100 committees, such as the Concrete Committee I spoke of. All disciplines from metallurgy, ceramics, just name it, and they have work on it, and it is it's a standardization committee, but it's also a research committee or a society. I don't mean committee, yes. Society.
Yes.
Then I expect that of equal importance to my colleagues and myself and Purdue has been the years of effort that I put in the work of the Harvard Research Board as National Research Council. And that, I was active in that area before I came to Purdue. I was on a committee or two. And then when I came to Purdue, I was put in the limelight, so to speak, even though I was only 34. I was immediately put into, made a workhorse in much committee work, and I tried to choose the committees that would do Purdue the most good, where I could bring my younger men into the picture. And through that, I, I received the Best Paper Award 1 year. Then ultimately I was elected to the Executive Committee, and in 1956 I became the chairman of the entire committee, which I consider quite an honor. I'm real proud of the fact that I chaired that. And that has a, at an annual meeting, they'll have 3,000 people from all over, not only this country, but all over the world. This comes into Washington, the Sheraton Park Hotel, to those meetings. And I attended those meetings from 1938 continuously until I became sick in 1968. And that about broke my heart when I had to quit going to the Harvard Research Board, because I had never missed a meeting up until then. Then, out of this, there's an association known as the American Association of State Highway Officials, a national grouping of people from all the states.
Yes, it's like the Commissioners for Public Utilities.
Yes.
NARUC.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, that group has been active. One of my important papers, I didn't mention, was published by that group back in 1937 when I was still in Ohio on proposed specifications for handling earthwork, which was quite a new concept of earthwork at that time, and it's still a sound specification. I'm quite proud of that, but in any event,
Now, do you people, in your line of work, do you join Sigma Psi, the National Science Fraternity?
Yes.
You join those?
Yes. Matter of fact, I chaired Purdue's Sigma Psi for a couple of years.
I thought you had.
Well, I followed Henry Haas. Mm-hmm. I was his vice chairman, and I had to serve out of his year, and they felt sorry for me and elected me for another two-year term after that. So I expect I chaired Purdue's chapter longer than any other person.
Have you gone into the National Science AAAS and so on? Have you worked with those groups?
Not especially, although...
That's not your specialty, is it?
No, but I've, up until I became ill, I kept in close contact with their publications
In the sense of chairing committees, you didn't work with them.
That's correct.
You were, in other words, your work is in your own field, naturally. Well, that's good. That's enough.
My own field is pretty broad.
You bet it is.
In any event, while I was chairman of the Highway Research Board in 1956, this American Association of State Highway Officials had decided that they would build a $25 million test road in Illinois. $25 million is a lot of test road. And they wanted somebody to chair their advisory committee, which was made up of 70 people. Well, 35 And then I each had an alternate, and there was always 70 there. And I chaired that for years while that was being built and while I was running tests.
Where is the road, incidentally?
Well, it's Interstate 80, now Interstate 80, and it's has signs on it that says this is the original Asheville Road Test, National Road Test. It's Old Grundy County. It's northern, north central in, Illinois.
Around Joliet West to the
North
Davenport.
Yeah. A little north, yes. Mm-hmm. That was quite an undertaking for me because of the great divergence of opinions that was represented on this advisory committee. You had industry, and you had trucking interests, and you had the Automobile Association, and you had state highway officials, and you had some university people, and yet it was a very, very difficult kind of group to preside over. But I'd had, it's really, I expect, served me pretty well because I later became president of this ASTM, which is still not an easy job to handle either.
I hope you don't mind my saying that what you have been testifying to is your ability to work with people and lead them.
What has happened really, I think, is that I do have one mild ability, maybe, and that is to find out what a person can do best and not to cause them to change jobs just because they aren't fitting in something that ought to be done, but to try to find something that the person can do and do well. And in my committee work, I use this technique of finding out what the people could do, and on this actual road test, for instance, in Illinois, that was a very difficult thing to preside over. My technique there, I knew most of these people to start with, but some of them were quite talkative and some weren't. This is always the case. And when I had a delicate situation, I would let discussion just go very freely, unless they wouldn't stay on the topic. I would keep them on the topic. And soon, it didn't take very many weeks until the people that were wrong, everybody knew it. And the people that were thinking straight, everybody knew it. And by the time that road test was well underway, it was being run by people that were doing the best thinking. And in that respect, perhaps I made a contribution, but I didn't personally, you see, do the thinking. As chairman, you don't speak.
The chairman is the person who sits in the chair.
That's correct. And only twice in those years of presiding, there was only twice that I asked my vice chairman, was this man Rex Whitten, to take the chair because I wanted to make a point, and twice I did do this, which is quite permissible,
of course,
but not too effective if you do very much of it. Pretty soon you become known as somebody that's running the show, and you don't want that.
You know, I didn't ask you. In undergraduate academic honors, we passed those up yesterday. Did you get any undergraduate academic honors that you'd like to talk about or remember? You know, I goofed on that because you told me about how you were asked to come and teach a class. Obviously, it wasn't just grades. I don't know what the civil engineering honoraries are. I know about Tau Beta Pi, of course.
Well, Tau Beta Pi and Chi Epsilon are the two. Tau Beta Pi is engineering and Chi Epsilon is civil engineering. These two, of course, have been important to me for a long time. But I've had other non-Purdue honors too. I suppose it's appropriate to mention the Ohio State granting me the Distinguished Alumnus Award in 1961.
I don't really think it's important. I think we ought to get it in. And may I ask you if you would like to read into the record a letter that you received in January 1970 from a representative of Ohio State University.
It was the president of Ohio State.
Yes. I'll turn it off while we...
I think I've had three papers from the president.
Mr. Woods has handed me a paper to read from the Ohio State University from President Novice G. Fawcett, dated January 2nd, 1970. Dear Professor Woods, I am delighted to inform you that the University Board of Trustees has unanimously and enthusiastically approved a recommendation that the Centennial Achievement Award be conferred upon you. You richly deserve this honor, and I hope you will accept. In observance of the university's centennial year, 1970, 100 Centennial Achievement Awards will be made. The recipients have been selected on the basis of unusual and distinctive service to the university. The recommendations to the board were made by university-wide selections committee made up of senior faculty members following nominations by the colleges. Presentation of the Centennial Award Centennial Achievement Awards will be made at the commencement convocation on December 18, 1970. A fitting and inspiring climax to the university's year-long centennial observance. It is our hope that all recipients of the Centennial Achievement Award will be able to be present on that occasion. I hope that I may hear from you soon and that you will accept the deserved tribute. Appropriate publicity will be given to this reward at a later date. I would appreciate having the award kept in confidence until we release this information to the press. We will advise you next fall concerning specific arrangements. In the meantime, may I express to you my warmest congratulations and my great personal pleasure in this recognition. Cordially, Novice G. Fawcett, President. This, of course, is one of the nicest things that an alumnus can receive from any university. To be one of 100 men chosen, the centennial is, I think, a distinguished tribute.
Yeah. I'm real proud of that. I really am.
Well, you should be proud of it.
And I have had additional correspondence from the president, and in a recent letter he wrote me that there would be release of this material on October 28, so that at that time it will become public information.
It is not public information until that date.
That's correct, yes.
Well, let's go on. That's a splendid achievement. I'll never do anything like that for my university.
Oh.
But I would like to ask, let's go on with honors. Anything else?
Well,
have you ever received any recognition from a foreign country?
Not that I remember of. I don't believe so.
All right. Anything from the United States government for a contribution in war, diplomas?
Oh, yes. I have quite a few of those. Mostly, I really can't put my fingers on them. They're all hanging in my office around the wall. But the Minuteman, I remember, I got an award for an outstanding contribution of a board of consultants on the Grand Forks, North Dakota, when they were having great problems with construction of the Minuteman. And I wasn't the only one. There was a group of us that worked on this, and we solved their problem. And I think all of us got an award. And
well, your rewards have been from the Department of Commerce, from the United States Air Force, Army. Any from the Navy?
None from the Navy, no. I have, though, the American Society of Civil Engineers about 64. Gave me the James Laurier, L-A-U-R-I-E, award. He was the first president of the American Society of Civil Engineers, and they give that award about every 3 years. I'm quite proud of that. The ASTM again awarded me in 1962 or three the Frank Richards award for outstanding contributions in the field of concrete, and then the Indiana Society of Professional Engineers in the early 60s gave me the Engineer of the Year award. Those dates I don't have.
Any date that you don't have at the moment can be put into the manuscript at the time that you correct it. So go right ahead. Go on.
Well, I think those are all I jotted down in the way of awards and honors.
I would think one of the biggest awards and honors you could get would have your graduate students do well. I'm beginning to have one or two that I'm following up and corresponding. Would you like to say a word about any of your graduate students who you think have been outstanding?
Yes, I that perhaps is the greatest satisfaction I have today is to see these boys here at Purdue or elsewhere making good. For instance, John McLaughlin down the street, 40 years old, former graduate student that I had.
His name is spelled M-C-L-A-U-G-H-L-I-N.
That's correct. And we've spoken of Bill Dulce. Now, Bill was a chem engineer, and then he did his doctorate work in chemistry. So he did not appear in my classes. But Dr. Mellon in chemistry, now retired, and I, and this was a strange one, served as co-chairman of his dissertation. That's a rare one, isn't it?
It is rare. Well, he couldn't get two tougher men.
Well, Mellon is a real gentleman, too. A wonderful person. My goodness, I have, it would be wrong to try to point out you could point out a few, but it would, you'd miss an awful lot. But Dick Walker received his doctorate here not too many years ago, is now head of civil engineering. Just heard that yesterday. Head of civil engineering at Virginia Polytechnic Institute.
VPI.
VPI. We have, I had another boy by the name of Shoup that's Dean of Engineering at the University of Hawaii. I remember...
Was Fadum one of yours?
No, Fadum is a Harvard PhD. Fadum is... Fadum is not too much younger than I am, but some. But he did not do work at Purdue. But I'm a great admirer of Ralph Fadum. I like him very much. He was a Casa Grande boy from Harvard, and a very, very fine person. University of West Virginia has a man from here that became head of civil and now is an associate dean of engineering. And that name escapes me at the moment.
We can fill it in.
But that gives you a little idea of the accomplishments of some of the people that have gone through the mill. And of course, you can't help but be proud of these boys. Invariably, they'll come back and tell me how much they appreciate having worked with me. And I invariably will say, that is not the answer. you have to make certain that you pick up some young fellow as I picked you up and make certain that he gets along. This is your obligation to society. You aren't obligated to me because somebody picked me up when I was young, too. And that, I think if I had my way, I would make every civil engineering student take a good course in history or a sequence of courses in history.
Why?
Oh, I think it's the most fundamental of the humanities from the standpoint of trying to learn why people made mistakes and trying to make certain we don't make the same mistakes. If people would read more history and do less yakking right now, I think we'd be better off.
There seems to be a split in applied science educators. One group saying, we are here to learn something in applied science, therefore humanities, communications, and English, while they're important, but communications should only extend to the ability to write a good business letter or a good report. Others take your point of view. How does Purdue stack up from where you sit on this? Is Purdue too much one-sided?
Well, I fear that we are a little bit on the that Purdue does not share completely my thinking on the subject.
I know it doesn't. I can name one or two of your colleagues who say that the fine arts, foreign language, history, and other similar subjects should be relegated to Indiana University, and there you study them. If you want to come here to learn physics or math or something, you come here to learn something that is worthwhile and that can be applied.
Well, of course, I've told you two or three times, I took a lot of liberal arts when I was a student, and it had its...
had its effect.
Oh, there's no question.
As I look at your library here, I see a lot of books on American history, particularly the Civil War.
Yeah.
Is that one of your hobbies?
Yeah, Civil War is. And then recently I picked up a book that had been around the house here for a long time, many years, on world religions. And so I've started studying world religions. And I find that it doesn't make much difference. The books that I read on world religion, I try to make certain that they are they don't come to me with a prejudice. I don't want to become a Presbyterian or a Catholic or a Jew or whatnot because I read a book. But I do like to know what a Presbyterian believes and what a Jew believes and why he believes it. So I have a pretty fair well.
You have excellent library.
Well, here, for instance, you're acquainted with that.
Oh, yes.
And that's pretty hard for me to go through because I have to use a magnifying glass and big. But that's the World's Great Religions by the Editors of Life.
Yeah.
Now, what I do, I have a great many of these different hobbies that I'm on all the time. But what I do on these books on religion, for instance, I have I keep a batch of stenographer books, and on one side of it I keep my logs. You're in my log for yesterday. You'll be in it for today.
Yep.
And then I have on the back side of it. There's stuff on world religions, so I don't have to read the whole book again to pick it up, and that I find quite useful, and it's I find it I find the only problem that really irks me is the fact that I don't have enough time. I really would like to spend more time on my books, but and since I I go to the office once a week or so. I'm going all day tomorrow, for instance. We have a bunch of meetings tomorrow. And John McLaughlin and Bill Dolce and some of these boys have asked me especially if I would come over tomorrow. And I, of course, wouldn't let them down for anything. But it's a big meeting with the State Highway Commission.
Let me ask you, sir. As you look back on Purdue and Purdue's role in your area of education, what has been the chief contribution of Purdue to American education?
Well, I don't know that that can be answered too easily. There are, if you want to take the strictly technical viewpoint, Purdue has made a tremendous contribution in engineering. I don't think there's any question. I know this is true, because I've studied Purdue's engineering, and then I've traveled in engineering institutions.
Well, you know, they say that we train great section heads, and we do good things to get things done. Somebody's got to be dumb enough to stick his head in the machine. The MIT boy will design the machine, but the Purdue boy will keep it running, stick his head in it, and look at it, and keep it going. Is this, does this have any truth to it?
Oh, I think so. And I would start back with the early development that came about, as we mentioned yesterday, through Goss.
Right straight down through Potter, then.
That's correct.
And George.
And you see, there's the end point of that is that the registrar, historically, would, and still, will accept only the top 15 or 20% of a class from out of the state. And in those days when we had 50% of our engineers from out of the state, this was almost a private institution from the standpoint of quality, because the boys in the lower 10% of the class couldn't compete with the boys in the top 15% of their class from out of state. They couldn't compete.
Do you think it's harder to maintain quality and excellence with increase in numbers?
Oh, I don't. I think there's a ceiling in which you probably lose some quality, but in civil engineering at Purdue, if I might use that as an example, an area that I'm more acquainted with than others, I think we have a good-sized school, just about right. We have about 300 to 400 sophomores, juniors, and seniors. We graduate 100 a year, and we have done this on the average since 1910. And since 1950, we've built graduate programs until in recent years we turn out as many men with master's and doctorate degrees as we do with bachelor's degrees.
In other words, Purdue's civil engineering is primarily research-oriented and graduate-oriented.
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. Now, University of Illinois is big in engineering, not as big as Purdue, but in civil engineering they're exceptionally big at Illinois. And they have, for instance, in a graduate course in pre-stressed concrete, a couple of years ago, they had one class with 70-some men in it. Now that's too large a class, a graduate class. That's much too large. If you, the ideal size class, as far as my experience has been concerned, is I like a class of about 15.
What about the small classes that you hear advocated at places like Rice and Caltech? They say, you talk to men representing those schools, oh, Purdue is all right, it's a big school, but we at Caltech and at Rice, why, we're so much greater. Now, does that apply for civil engineering too?
Well, I've been to Caltech and Rice, both, and their civil engineering in both instances is so small that it's insignificant in terms of turning out to, for the
In other words, they're good engineering schools, but in civil engineering, not.
No, I think they're good, but they don't have customers. No, they're good. No, Rice is good and Caltech's good. No, I wouldn't say they're not good. They are good, and they have good staff.
I just wanted to get it on the tape.
Yes, but but why they don't get more customers, I don't know. You see, Rice has a extremely rugged entrance requirement. They don't accept anything but the very best of records, and yet they have funkers, and just like we do too. I don't understand that. And Caltech, they're especially good in, in their sanitary field, sanitary engineering, Caltech. By the way, this has historically been true of Harvard. Their sanitary engineering has been, I'd say, perhaps the best in the world.
The interesting thing about Harvard Engineering School is they have very few people, but very large endowment. I presume that's because they're not going to compete with MIT.
Well,
or on the undergraduate level.
Yes, and then I think the administration at Harvard, this is my opinion, now I don't know this as a fact, but my opinion is that the administration has discouraged engineering to the extent that it's becoming less and less significant.
As an undergraduate? Oh, my, yes. This is true. What about Cornell?
Cornell, I'd say Cornell is a good school. It's not, I kind of hate to make comparisons between Purdue and some other school, because Purdue's situation is quite unique, I think, in that we're fairly large, and we have this large spread in curriculum, and we have these numbers of students that come from all over this country and Canada and elsewhere. that's true to some extent at Cornell, but I believe to a lesser degree historically than Purdue in engineering.
Cornell is a top engineering school.
Oh, yes.
Among the Big Ten, you hear about Michigan's engineering, and you hear about Illinois' engineering, and you hear about Ohio State's. Am I right in that? That they're all good schools?
Oh, yes.
What about the civil engineering in each of them?
Well, I wouldn't... I really think that Purdue tops the Big Ten in civil engineering. Even though Illinois has a larger school in civil engineering. But next to Illinois, we have the largest civil school in the Big Ten. And I think we're about right. But Michigan, I wouldn't downgrade Michigan's civil engineering. I wouldn't downgrade Michigan State's either.
I forgot about Michigan State.
And Wisconsin.
What does Michigan State distinguish as an engineering school?
Well, it was pretty mediocre back a couple dozen years ago, perhaps. But they have brought in some pretty good talent in their administration. Some people think that they're too highly theoretical now.
But that's what they say about Purdue. And we don't teach people who can get out and work with equipment, machinery, do anything. All we do is teach about solid state physics, and then we're too theoretical.
Well,
I know one of our colleagues in metallurgy here and in industrial engineering says that. We're getting so theoretical that companies can't work with us, machine tool companies and so on.
Well, this is true in some schools of engineering at Purdue, but not all. It's not true of civil. That's for sure. I can guarantee you that. But about 10 or 15 years from now, we may we may, because we've, if the administration at Purdue should insist on early developments of the PhD student, I think I mentioned this yesterday, we could have some troubles 15 years from now, but right now we're not in this kind of trouble. There's too many people with my kind of background that has both the academic and also the know-how.
Yeah.
Well, this consulting would indicate
why certainly
that I've had some know-how, or I wouldn't be called in.
Wouldn't be there. That's true.
And this is true of Bill Dulles and John McLaughlin,
yeah,
and I can name Jerry Leonards and Milt Haar. I can name lots and lots of these boys in civil engineering that have the know-how. Now, whether or not their PhDs coming out at a younger age will have this, I don't know. See, Jerry Leonards is an example. Was head right after I was, but he did his work, his doctorate work here. He was a Canadian. He did his original work at McGill, and he worked for several years before he came to Purdue. He worked as an engineer. Now Milt Haar now heads up soil mechanics. He got his undergraduate work, I think, at Rutgers, someplace in the East. I think it was Rutgers. But he had years of experience before he tackled his PhD. Well, now he has balance, you see. And Jerry Leonards has balance.
Yeah.
And I can name lots more of them that have the...
We've forgotten two engineering schools in our suite for swing around the country. That might be of interest. What about Georgia Tech and Pennsylvania State? Are they outstanding schools in CE?
Georgia Tech and North Carolina State.
I said Pennsylvania State.
Yeah, I know you did, but and Florida at Gainesville. Those three are, in my mind, outstanding in the South. I would hesitate to compare a Southern school versus a Northern school. One of the problems that you get in other schools in those three. Now those three are pretty well balanced between graduate and undergraduate programs, and they're not ingrained with their own people. They're graduates from all over. We have a PhD. They've got his PhD here on the staff of Georgia Tech, for instance. We have a couple of North Carolina, two PhDs that I know of, and these boys are, that's Paul Cribbins and Greg Mullen. These boys are they had experience before they got their doctorate. Now, when you go to Pennsylvania. You said Pennsylvania State. That institution I wouldn't hesitate to send a child of mine to Pennsylvania State. I don't believe they have the balance that we have, but that doesn't mean that they can't be good. The other school, engineering school, I have to confine this to engineering because I don't know the rest of it. But the other schools in the South, so frequently they are, they start with people from the South and they end up with people on the staff from the South.
Is this the trouble with Texas A&M?
That's one of the big problems, Texas, in my opinion.
Well, is Texas first and civil engineering second? Would it be that way, or is it just that they...
I frankly don't know.
They want local boys, I see.
Well, another thing, see, one of these jobs that I had around the country was the accreditation committee for the College Engineering Committee for Professional Development. And I was on the civil ASCE Committee on Education. And out of that, they put me on the accreditation group, and ultimately I became a chairman of Region 5, and that included Louisiana, Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and I made many, many trips to the most of the engineering institutions. And the student body, you don't see much transfer between the North and the South and the student body. Now, that's a strange thing, but it's true. I don't know quite why, but they, if they graduate from a school in the South, they stay in the South. If they graduate from a school in the North, they stay in the North. Well, as a general statement, that's not completely
true,
of course.
Well, how are they in quality and performance? Do they, where do you get the best civil engineering in the United States? I mean best in terms of quality.
Well, we've named four or five good institutions in the Big Ten. I've been to MIT and I've been to Harvard, but I think Harvard's a special case. And MIT may be because of the strong orientation on the tremendous research budgets that they develop, and the lack of interest in really turning out their students seems to be their second interest. Now, I may be wrong, but that's my impression on the three or four times I've been to MIT. I think a fairly good school is Rensselaer Polytechnic at Troy, New York. I would rather not send a boy to some of these small schools like University of Vermont, University of New Hampshire. We have a PhD that's head of civil at University of Vermont. I think his total staff, I think he's one of four, so it must be a very small student body, and that's not very helpful, I don't believe.
Well, where do you get the best civil engineering training? In the Big Ten, among the schools that we have named, and on the West Coast, places like Caltech, Stanford?
I think I'd put Stanford in there. I'd put Berkeley in there. Unless the Hootens have taken over since I've been there, I don't know. But they've had a strong civil area there for a long time. You get out into the plains, and they have so many schools in there that means it becomes
places
smaller.
Places like Nebraska, Ames.
Nebraska is not too bad. Ames, at one time, Ames was had a very strong civil group. As a matter of fact, head of public roads, Thomas H. McDonald, who was an Ames man. He's long since deceased, but we had Earl Kelly in the Bureau of Tests, and the Bureau of Public Roads was Ames, and their soils man was Hogentogler. By the way, he was a Pennsylvania State man. But there were five or six important people in this country that really ran the highway industry that came from Ames. And then they got a new dean in there, and he said, "We don't want to fool with this sort of thing," and out the window it went. And it's taken them 20 years to recover from that. I used to think that the administration didn't have much influence, but the older I get, the more I can see where maybe they don't. But if you get a poor one in there, you can do a lot of wrecking real quickly.
Well, let me ask you. Come more land this. Has Purdue had good administration?
Oh yes. Oh yes. administration at Purdue, all the way to the president, and on many occasions I've been called into the board of trustees too, for technical things that the president has asked me to appear. You stop to think of George Hawkins and Potter. Why, you couldn't go wrong with people like that running your show for you. At one time, Hawkins had Tom Jones, now president of South Carolina, University of South Carolina. He had Paul Cina, now director of research for General Motors. He had Briggs Golding, who is now president of what was that state school out of Dayton? There's a new school.
What do you mean, in Ohio?
In Ohio.
Not the University of Dayton. That's where Mark Greene went.
No, this is a new school. Yes, I know Greene. This is a new school. But Bridge, in other words, there's three men that were heads of engineering here at Purdue under Hawkins.
And of course, Cina is director of research for General Motors. Not a bad job.
That's right. That's correct.
Well, we have, do you know George Grosch, the present dean?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, I know him quite well.
In other words, you rather approve of the way we've done things at Purdue.
Oh, yes, I think that the administration at Purdue has been, I'll be brash enough to say it's the best administration that I've seen in my travels at universities and colleges around this country in engineering. It's
very
the best.
Good. I think we can stop on that note. Do you have something you'd like to add? Now, have we touched on everything? I'll stop the tape for a moment. You mentioned a moment ago, sir, that you had a story that you'd like to add. Would you care to put that in now?
Yes. A good many years ago, as a matter of fact, about 1944, one of our very fine staff men in Joint Highway Research went to Virginia to set up a highway research program, which ultimately migrated to the University of Virginia, by the way. But soon after he was there, a couple of years later, he wrote me and asked me if I would appear on their first road school program, which was being held in Lexington, Virginia, and would I give the group a little outline of what constitutes a good highway research program and what constitutes a good way of organizing it and so on. And I wrote that I would be glad to do so. And so I went to Lexington, and they had made reservations in the hotel. And then I went to register, and I got my program. And this was in the morning, and the program that I was to talk to, or the group that I was to talk to, was being held in the afternoon, and this is a military school, you know. And on the program, for the first time, I noticed that the presiding officer was Governor Tuck of the state of Virginia, and the first speaker was Senator Byrd, the old gentleman, and the third speaker was Robinson. Senator Robinson from Virginia. The fourth speaker was Thomas H. McDonald, the famous director of public roads in Washington, and I was fifth. And I literally sweat blood to be on a program with this caliber of person on such a drab subject as what constitutes a good highway research program. And I sat up on that stage and they brought all the cadets in and they had a full house, hundreds of people. General Tuck, Governor Tuck, called a meeting to order at the proper time. And then he announced that that Senator Byrd couldn't show, but that the senator had sent three from the House. And each one of these men was introduced, and each one thought Tuck was quite a nice person and gave about a 15 or 20 minute talk. And then Senator Robinson was introduced, and he thought Tuck was quite a nice person. And then we had a couple of battles in the Civil War, and he remembered being on top of the Blue Ridge Mountains and looking down the Great Valley and seeing haystacks burning that the Yankees had fired, and but there wasn't anybody smiling, so I didn't either. And then Thomas H. McDonald finally came on, and he was a fine person, but his delivery was always monotonous and long.
Put everybody to sleep.
Oh, it was terrible. And from the standpoint of being, he was way late, you see, to get on, and then he talked and talked and talked. He read a long paper. And then I was last, and Tuck and said, now here's the part of the program we all came for. We have the man that has set up Harvard Research at Purdue, and we want to know all about Harvard Research, and now I give you, and he looked at his watch and he says, oh, good heavens, Professor Wood, would you mind just taking a bow? We have to be on the parade grounds in 3 minutes. And I think today that Governor Tuck was the sharpest boy in the outfit. Because that was quite a kindness to me and to the audience. But I didn't know until that last split second that I wasn't going to be on.
Well, did you get your paper printed?
Well, the next year, they still wanted me, and I went back and gave it.
Oh, well, you made up for it. Well, sir, this has been most pleasant, and we can add to this. Now, I should say, for the benefit of the tape, that you will make a list of your publications, and they will be appended to the typescript as after you have edited. Is this correct?
Yes, it's correct. If I can get somebody to do it.
Well, I think Mr. Hawkins could arrange for that, Nadine, if necessary.
I'll have to talk to McLaughlin to
see. McLaughlin will see it's done, I'm sure.
It could be that it's all done. I don't know. Maybe it's done. But there's a list of there's a big bound, maybe volumes, I don't know, of all my papers, or most of them, 100 or so, and books and bulletins and papers published. And that's in the Civil Engineering Library, and I think this ought to be in the record here.
Well,
something should
happen. That it's put in.
And then I think that the girl that did that, you see what happened? I didn't get everything done before I became ill. These were in progress, these things, when I became ill. And I think that that's been done, and that it's just a matter of copying that from the record.
Well, it'll be added to it in the form of an appendix, you may be sure.
And then I have, in addition, I think I've pointed out that the 10 most important publications, I think, from time to time. And I do want to mention for the record that the toughest jobs I ever did were those two or three court cases I was on. Those one for the Lehigh Cement Company, one for the Buffalo Roller Spring Company. Roller Company in Springfield, Ohio, and the third one was for the Hanna Company in Hibbing, Minnesota, and those were all very, very difficult cases.
You mentioned the three cases, but you didn't mention the name. Thank you for putting it in, and perhaps you can make that adjustment when we edit it. Well, I am certainly delighted to have had a chance to talk to you, and I believe that those who listen to the tapes will too. And thank you very much, Mr. Wood.
Well,
and I have a nice trip back east to New Hampshire. I wish I were going with you.
Let me add one point.
Yes, sir.
In the event the listener should get the impression these things were of my own making. I want to emphasize very strongly that it's been my colleagues that has made possible all the good things that have come to me. And my colleagues are the most important thing the most important asset I have. Thank you.
On that appropriate note, we will end the interview. This is the end of take 2.